I think it's interesting to speculate about the possibility of dark and negative influences at the spiritual level and positive and benign influences. And the human dilemma always, always is the dilemma to choose between the two. A friend of mine calls this world, this realm that we live in, a university of duality. And I think that's a rather interesting idea, because a lot of people object to the idea of duality and would like everything just to be one and all beautiful, it's all goodness, and whatever duality there is something that we're just projecting. But I'm not sure how much we would have to learn from a world like that. I think duality is actually a very useful teaching tool, and that without it, it's very difficult to make choices that define us. It is not all there is. But in this particular experience, in the experience of being a human in a human body, in this physical realm, duality has very important lessons to teach us. And were it to be taken away, what choices would we have to make? And if we didn't make choices, how could we grow? How could we learn? How could we develop?
Are there not potential dangers, though, with such a viewpoint of duality, in the sense of the individual becomes the arbiter of what is good and what is bad? Now, again, has history not shown numerous people working in a direction that they perceive to be good that may be deemed by history to have been bad?
Sure, good point.
And furthermore, is there something which is perhaps slightly going against a number of mystical traditions, both Christian mysticism and what might be called agnostic mysticism, as well as more Eastern forms of spiritual thinking, of unity, that the good and the bad are always together, the black and the white are always together, night and day. There's this harmony of polarity as opposed to a battle of polarity.
Well, those are very interesting points. In ancient Egypt, the duality was represented by Horus and Set. So Horus, the forces of light, the sun, goodness, virtue; Set, chaos, disaster, misery, evil. And it's very interesting. I mean, really, if you want to inquire into spiritual matters, you can just go to the ancient Egyptians. They have a lot to teach us on that. And it's very interesting at Dendera that there's a single figure with two heads, and those two heads are the heads of Horus and Set. And I think they're telling us something there. So yes, I mean, I don't disagree that there is an overarching oneness, but I still feel very strongly that remove the need to choose between different courses of action, and you remove a fundamental teaching tool. I mean, nobody knows what we're doing here on this earth in this physical realm. There really is no, science cannot claim to have the answer to that. Science may say, materialist, you know, Western reductionist science tends to say that this is all just an accident, that there is absolutely no purpose to it whatsoever, that it's just random processes working through that led to the evolution of life, that there is no such thing as the spirit, that when we die, we're dead. There is no conscious survival of death in any form. This is not me saying this. This is, I'm trying to summarize the model of reductionist Western science, and that in a word, there is no purpose to it, no transcendent purpose whatsoever. It's just purely accidental. And science may be right about that, but it equally well could be completely wrong about that. And another possibility has to be considered, that there is such a thing as, quote unquote, the soul, that consciousness may be a fundamental force of the universe rather than an epiphenomenon of brain processes, that consciousness may be engaged in a gigantic universal project of growth and development, and that what we have here on this earth in a physical incarnation, in a world with physical and material consequences, is an opportunity to learn, and to learn by the choices we make, and to be defined by the choices we make, and perhaps even to have the opportunity to come back and learn lessons again and again and again. After all, many wise ancient cultures say that. They say that we do reincarnate, we do come back again and again, and that there's a project going on, there's a reason for that. And if that were the case, then I can see a tremendous value to duality and to the need to make these choices. And yes, it's true that different what may be evil for one culture may be regarded as good by another culture. And the same action, for example, killing another person, might in one circumstance be regarded as incredibly evil and wicked, and might in another circumstance be regarded as actually a really good thing to do. I think most people wouldn't dispute that it would probably have been a good thing to kill Hitler. But it would still have involved killing another human being. So we get into very complicated moral inquiries and choices here, which it's difficult actually to resolve. But I think it can be reduced to a fairly simple level. Does the action that I am about to take transgress on the sovereignty of others? Does the action that I'm about to take add even one iota to the misery in the world? Or does it reduce it? And I think if we ask ourselves those questions, then what is good and what is evil become a little clearer to define. But I think if we all examine our hearts, we do actually have some kind of compass on this, which you know, we do know this isn't really the right thing to say. This isn't really the right thing to do. That voice is there. And I'm not sure that it's entirely culturally constrained.
And on that note, and continuing this particular line of inquiry, going back to your novels, in investing so much narrative space to the darkness, to the brutality, is this in some way exorcising it? Are you hoping, as you say about this repetition of events and this ancient conflict, is your choice here to focus to such a degree on the darkness as a means of opening it up, allowing people to see it for what it is? Is there some purpose to this?
Yeah, I do in Entangled and latterly in War God focus a lot on very negative human behavior, and I describe scenes of violence in considerable detail. And it's very difficult for me as a human and as a writer to write those scenes. It causes me pain, but I feel that it's essential for me to do so. And there's a number of reasons why I feel that. One is that we have, I've observed, a tremendous capacity as a species for denial. Mm-hmm. That if something is painful or difficult, we look away. We tend not to want to focus on it. We may even persuade ourselves that that's the right thing to do, but it's precisely in that act of looking away that we allow the wickedness to flourish. Whereas in fact, we should focus our attention on it and willfully seek to stop it. And that requires knowing what it is. A lot of people who have read Entangled and not liked it have not liked it because of the violence. I can't tell you how many letters I've received which told me that they were so deeply offended by the violence in Entangled, and that, you know, we have to concentrate on goodness only, and that we it's all goodness really and all light. And I have to reply to that. Not a single action that is described in Entangled was made up by me. Everything that happens in there, whether it's the castration of enemies and the wearing of their genitals on one's head, or whether it's various disgusting forms of human sacrifice, all of these things, all of them, every one of them, have been done by human cultures, and some of them are still being done by human cultures today. This is part of the human phenomenon. And I think if we turn our heads away and don't look at that and pretend that everything is a rosy glow of goodness, we'll never deal with those problems. So what I'm wanting to do with this writing is to put that right up front and to put it into the faces of my readers and say, here it is. This happened. This happens. It's a reality. Deal with it. Mm. That's what we need to do as a species. If we're going to move on out of this dark place, and the world is in a very dark place right now, and horrendous things are happening all over the world, We're not going to solve those problems by pretending they don't exist. We have to confront them. And in order to confront them, they have to be expressed. And I've felt that in my writing, it's my role to express them, not with a view to reveling in them or enjoying them, but rather to showing my readers what these things are, and hopefully raising the opportunity to address. I always do also try to show that there are good forces at work as well, and that again and again and again, it comes down to choice. You know, Cortés could have made different choices when he entered Mexico. Moctezuma and the Aztecs, the Mexica, could have made different choices. For me, it's interesting to speculate what would have happened to the world if things had gone differently during the Spanish conquest of Mexico. And it's one of the reasons that I've written War God, as a matter of fact. It's very clear. Cortés turns up on the coast of Mexico with 490 men, and he is confronting a large, organized state, which is the Mexica state. People call them the Aztecs, but they're better known as the Mexica. And it seems implausible somehow that even though they have a few guns and 18 or 16 cavalry and some military science, it seems implausible that this tiny band of Spaniards are going to overthrow this gigantic and truly violent state. I mean, the Mexica were into systematic, organized state violence and terrorism. They used human sacrifice not only to placate their gods, but as a means of terrorizing their neighbors. And they would put on spectacles of human sacrifice for their neighbors to show their neighbors what would happen to them if they stopped paying tribute or didn't do exactly what they were told. So it seems implausible that this tiny Spanish army could, not even an army, it's just a bunch of freebooters, could turn up and overthrow this gigantic edifice. But I maintain, and what I'm trying to show in War God, is that the reason they were able to overthrow it was precisely because of the choices that the Aztecs, the Mexica, had made. If Moctezuma had reversed this policy of human sacrifice, if he had sought to cultivate friendship with his neighbors, if he had behaved in a loving and generous way towards neighboring peoples, then they would not have joined Cortés. That's really why Cortés won, because he was able to recruit hundreds of thousands of local auxiliaries, people who absolutely detested the Aztecs. And they detested them for very good reasons, because the Aztecs were coming along not only extracting taxes and tribute from them, but taking their young men and women and murdering them on the sacrificial stone. It's very reasonable, if somebody comes along and says, I can free you from that, to say, absolutely, let's go for it. And that's why Cortés won. So a choice was there, always was there with the Aztecs, with Moctezuma. They could have chosen not to pursue that route anymore. And had they made that choice, I believe that Cortés would have been confronted by a united opposition on the coast of Mexico. Yeah. And he would have been wiped out. Yeah. And the whole European venture of colonialism that followed would have had to have been rethought. If they had faced a truly powerful and united force in Mexico, I think it would have affected the entire way that Europe related to the countries that it invaded and colonized in the decades subsequently. I mean, it's immediately obvious in the Spanish conquest of Peru, which happened just a decade or so later, which literally followed the Cortés model to the letter. But it's obvious also much more widely around the world that European powers were persuaded that they could easily destroy and these so-called primitive and disorganized forces that confronted them. If they'd been taught a very sharp lesson at the time of Cortés, the whole model, I believe, would have been different. And the world we live in today would have been radically different.
And in addition to the cruelty of the Mexica, the Aztec, there's obviously the other aspect which Octavio Paz concentrates on in Labyrinth of Solitude, that the Mexica people were actually aware of the ending of a particular cycle.
Yes.
And do you, in your research and in your investigation into this, do you think that there was also a certain surrendering before the Spaniards as a fatalistic sense of inevitability?
That's complicated. I think that, first of all, the notion of the return of Quetzalcoatl and the notion that an age of the world was coming to an end was certainly very strong in Mexican society at that time. Revisionist history has tried to intervene. really that wasn't going on. But I don't agree with that. I think it's very clear from original documentation of the period that this was very central part of Mexico, and indeed broadly Central American thinking at that time. I mean, a lot of people say that the notion of the white bearded god who's returning is something that the friars made up. But, you know, if you go to La Venta, where we have the remains of the Olmec culture, you will find sculptures of I mean, I know it's not politically correct to say this, but I'm just reporting a fact. You will find sculptures that are at least 3,500 years old that show individuals who do actually look like Caucasians with large beards. And those are found elsewhere in Mexico as well, such as at Monte Albán, often in very old sites long predating this period. So this idea, there's something to this idea, and it's been expressed in iconography much long before the time of the Aztecs. So I think it was a very real idea. And the notion that there's a curious series of events that Quetzalcoatl is associated with the year one reed. There's a sort of cycle of 52 revolving years, and rather like the Chinese calendar has 12 named years, 52 in the Mexican calendar. And the year that's associated with Quetzalcoatl is one reed, and that's the year that he's born, supposedly, that's the year that he's expelled, and that's the year that he's supposed to return. And it just so happens that 1519, when Cortes turned up on the coast of the Gulf Coast of Mexico, was the year one reed. I mean, this actually, even in any European culture of that time, Europe was a pretty superstitious place at that time, such a coincidence would have been noted. And we can be absolutely certain that it was noted by Moctezuma and the Mexica. And it's also very clear from the documentation of the period that Moctezuma was quite convinced that he was dealing with the return of Quetzalcoatl, with the return of a god. At first, he was convinced of that. And I think that Cortes, who, if he was anything, was a skillful Machiavellian player, I think that Cortes very quickly learned of that. And in my story, I have him ultimately learning of it from Malinal, the woman who becomes his interpreter and mistress, very quickly learned of that and exploited it and used it. He was very clever. He never said, "I am Quetzalcoatl." He let them say it. And that was really one of the smartest things he did. He just left it to their own superstitious context to fill in the details and to revere in theory. And after all, he did have these formidable weapons. You know, they called them Zihuacoatl in the Mexican tradition, fire serpents. This notion that the gods had fire serpents that could destroy and dismember men aided him in his conquest. But when Moctezuma, as my reading of him, the man is a very weak and at the heart of things. But there were others amongst the Mexica who were not cowardly. For example, Guatemoc, who mounted a fierce resistance to Cortes. So the notion that the Mexica simply surrendered to Cortes, I think, is not correct. Once they really figured it out, and they did, after Moctezuma was gone, they really figured it out, that these things that are attacking us are human beings just like us, just a bit better armed, maybe a bit better organized, but they are men, and we're not going to let them walk all over us. That resistance did mount, and it mounted very, very strongly. I mean, the defense of Tenochtitlan at the end was bitterly fought over a very substantial period of time, and required, I think, enormous courage on the part of the Mexica to mount that defense, although in the end they were overrun. What I'm trying to show is that even in the worst circumstances, even in the darkest place that human beings can go, even in the midst of overwhelming wickedness and evil, it is possible for goodness and love to thrive and survive and to have an impact. That's ultimately the message I'm trying to bring across. And I think anybody who's studied the Second World War and has studied, you know, what happened under the Nazi atrocities will recognize some echoes in these two periods. That also in that period, even in the midst of the very worst things that human beings could possibly imagine doing to one another, there were tremendous examples of courage and goodness and self-sacrifice and decency. And this says something important, I believe, about the human spirit. Again, I don't want to turn away from the darkness of the period, but I do want to show that what is fundamentally good and light and beautiful and true about the human spirit was always there and did always manifest. Even if it didn't win, it was still speaking out for what we can be as a species. That's what I'm trying to show.